Welcome to the 36th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Terry Chad.
Much like Kevin Peterson, this podcast has been on something of a forced break of late. Much like Kevin Peterson, we're back and childishly demanding to be the centre of attention.
So we last recorded on the 14th of August, since when we're sure you've all been missing our voices. Andy's been in America, I've been doing not very much still in England. And we talked then about that was when the Kevin Peterson saga was sort of really beginning to
We had a good argument about it, didn't we?
We had a good argument. I mean, you said that it was all the fault of England, and I said it was mostly the fault of Kevin Peterson. And so now we've sort of got to the resolution of it, just as we start recording again. And in a sense, I'm quite glad, because otherwise we like everyone else, would just have ended up talking about it perpetually. And I think one of the annoying things about it has been, and one of the things that I think England have handled quite badly, is the way that they've just allowed it to be blown out of all proportion, almost. Obviously, he's important to the England side, but just from both from a PR perspective and just in the way that it seems to have affected the team, it just seems to have.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to reopen this debate, but ultimately, it's been resolved, and it's been resolved in the only way I think it had to, for the sake of England, that Kevin Peterson's back there. Most of the senior players have come out and made the right noises and basically said, look, we've got no problem with him, we're happy to play with him, etc., etc. I think you're right about the way it just became so much a big story, and I think it was Graham Swann who made the point that it totally overshadowed Andrew Strauss's final games. And for someone who...
Yeah, it did, and that was a huge pity, actually.
And I think one thing that is... I think Andrew Strauss is one of those completely uncontroversially popular figures, isn't he? I mean, some people maybe question how much of a kind of experiment he is as a captain, but I can't think of anyone who'd really, you know, so I think more people would have liked him to have had a good send-off.
And then the other pity has been that the whole thing has overshadowed the rather wonderful fact that the West Indies are world champions.
So this is one of those things, really, that if you continually predict something again and again, then you're eventually going to be right. And one of my hobbies on this podcast is predicting a West Indies resurgence.
West Indian world domination.
I was actually almost enraged by the fact that I didn't make any financial gain by this, by putting a bet, because I mean, literally, I've been predicting this, and I think a few people saw it.
No. Jonathan, you have been generally saying that the West Indies are going to.
Well,
be the thing that made
me very happy about this was the fact that Darren Sammy, I think, is a really, really good guy, and he's a great captain. I think he's really managed to unite a very slightly chaotic, disparate team with Otis Gibson, and they've got the team that's too often been just anarchic, pulling in the right direction. And the thing I thought particularly was quite, obviously Chris Gayle played a huge role, great to see him playing again. But actually what was amazing, when it came to the final and Gayle failed quite dismally.
Wasn't that a fantastic game?
It wasn't a great game. And Marlon Samuels, what a year he's had. For a player who generally, the consensus was, hasn't lived up to his potential, he saw them through. So great for the West Indies, and let's hope this is something they can build on. I mean, this would be the real challenge. You know, can they now become more competitive across the rest of the game?
In the 90s, when I was getting to know the game, the main way I did so, when the West Indies were sort of still looming large, was through CFAX, which earlier this week, actually, I think. Was shown for the final time on television. And it actually, I haven't looked at CFAX for a long, long time, but it reminded me when, because there were various sort of commemorations on the BBC about its passing. It makes it sound like my grandma died or something. And it reminded me just of the weird, weird way that I used to sit. It usually happened at school, actually, in the library. They had a television in the library at school where you were allowed to watch, you weren't allowed to watch television, but you were allowed to look at CFAX. And just the weird view of a cricket match you get when you only have the scorecard and you just see things change on a scorecard. And you don't have, as you have now on the BBC, on BBC Sport and on The Guardian and on Cricket Info, the live feed.
Ball by ball, yeah.
It's just the statistics are absolutely... everything, and it's an astonishing way to watch a game of cricket, actually.
And I think for a huge number of people, it was how, you know, a lot of games were followed, a lot of crucial overs at ends of games. I certainly remember it's a couple of England test matches, seeing whether England could hang on CFAX, and it's rather odd. It certainly outweighed its usefulness, but the thing I find funny about it is that I remember when I first started using CFAX, it seemed really snazzy, it seemed really impressive,
it really did.
And it's hilarious that now, a few years on, it's kind of hilariously quaint and out of touch.
We are the new generation.
Generation X.
Talking of new generation.
Well, exactly.
the Champions League going on. I mean, I have to admit actually, that when you said there's a Champions League going on at the moment,
you said when?
You looked quizzically and said, when's it starting?
Well, I slightly, if we're going on themes in this podcast, so I've said my highlight has been the West Indies winning, and I'm now going to say my low light is lots of 2020 cricket. These are very predictable things that I say again and again.
What we're not going to point out there is the fact that the West Indies won at 2020.
Yeah, okay. So a minor flaw. I don't actually have an objection to the Champions League trophy. I think it's quite a fun idea. I think the format's horrible, and you seem to end up with far too many dead rubbers. I like the fact the IPL team's getting beaten, but that there's something horrendous in the schedule that you would go straight from a 2020 World Cup to a Champions League trophy, and I just cannot believe that people aren't feeling overkill on this. I mean, I've paid it very, very little attention. And I just think it's that. I know it's something we come back to again and again, and everyone talks about again and again, but there's got to be balance in the schedule. And I just think this is a classic example of a 2020 pile-up.
One of the things 2020 was designed to bring about was the fact that a lot of people said we need to sort of have a more commercial marketing sense when it comes to thinking about cricket. Mm. So thinking out something like 2020 achieves that. But actually, essentially, the market saturation that we're now getting, particularly for a global televised audience that can now watch all this 2020, I wonder whether it's actually going to come to breaking point at some point. And somewhere along the way, there's just going to be so much happening that the reason that it was created in order to create a new market and in order to create lots of money is just going to completely fall through on those bases.
From the archives, and I'm sure many of you in our audience are club cricketers at some level. I'm sure many of you have been in that position where you've had a pretty awful game, you haven't bowled well, batted well or whatever, and the redeeming feature of the day has been that good tea, that solid tea. Toby is going to tell us a little bit more about the curious and eternal relationship between food and cricketers.
So all sportsmen and women have always had to watch what they eat in one way or other. But in most sports, the obsession for food takes the form of sort of performance-enhancing diet of protein shakes, strict regimes and things like that. But for cricketers, on the other hand, close attention to food seems to come simply because they want to eat the best food and lots of it too. Cricketers watch what they eat not because they want to deprive themselves of good food, but because they want to make sure they eat only good food. I always think it's interesting, the saga over Samit Patel's weight that has been happening over the last few years, just like the debate less high profile about Robert Key and the caricatures which have grown up around Inzamam Al-Haq, they all together prove one thing, which is not that cricket is concerned about food, but that actually cricket is the only sport where you can be that size and succeed.
It's interesting, Samit Patel's a sort of classic example, isn't it? Because basically England told him, go away, show you're committed, sort yourself out, and he just frankly didn't.
Yep.
But you're quite right that at the same time, he continued to perform at such a level, actually with both bat and ball, that England remained interested.
And ultimately, whilst a lot of cricket authorities do try and sort of appear to take a hard line on it, actually, they are responsible for quite a lot of the eating that goes on in the circuit, because cricket grounds pride themselves on the meals that they provide for the players. I've always thought it was interesting that the Wisden cricketer in their monthly player interview always ask where the best lunch on the international circuit could be.
So you're quite right. It's not a question a footballer is going to be asked.
Well, exactly.
You know,
it's not how good is your halftime orange? You ask a footballer or something like that. And by the way, the answer is usually Lord's, but the cream teas at Worcester give anything a run for their money, apparently. Partly, I suppose, this is natural, because when you have a cricket match that stretches across a period of time, when we'd normally consume breakfast, lunch and supper, or at least lunch and supper, certainly. In the era of 2020, perhaps we'll see this obsession with food lessening a bit, because the whole game can be played between breakfast and lunch, between lunch and supper, or even between supper and going to bed. Simon Hughes, in a lot of Hard Yakka, which we've reviewed on this show, talks about the tradition in the county game of having such a large lunch that when you went out to bowl afterwards, everyone, you know, immediately shuffled to the boundary and hoped that their captain wasn't going to call on them. And so there wasn't for a moment in Simon Hughes' account the thought that you could just have several fewer sandwiches. Instead, what has to happen is that the rhythm of the game has to change in order to accommodate the post-lunch slump. And similarly, a lot of the rhetoric that we use around sort of surviving until the lunch interval sort of sets stood up as this oasis within the hostilities. For someone like Mike Gassing, there was certainly no question of the cricket match getting in the way of the food. I mean, he was the typical person who really did have his cake.
And sort of slightly sadly, though, I imagine that I'd be curious to what extent how true this all is now, to what extent I'm sure some counties keep it up very strongly. I wonder, though, sadly, how many counties have maybe slid back to kind of, you know, a nice, healthy kind of tiny portion of pasta and salad. I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
But I imagine these forces of progress in inverted commas.
Well, certainly, looking further back, we do have these fantastic descriptions of the gentleman amateurs who liked to wine and dine in style. So W.G. Grace was reputedly started the day with port and a cigar. But actually my favourite is Arthur Carr, who was Harold Larwood's captain at Nottinghamshire, who was infamous for turning up. I mean, he was a great cricketer and he would have been probably England captain had he not been basically an alcoholic and also a massive fan of having enormous meals before, during and after cricket matches. There's a great description of him after a cricket match driving home afterwards and actually being so pissed by the time that he's actually in the car. So he must have been drinking during the game, that he drives to a hotel and he drives up the front steps of the hotel into the lobby and into the bar and sits there in his car, blows the horn and demands a drink. So more than there seems to be a natural affinity, in fact, between the game and food, because you know cricket more than any other sport sort of takes on the guise of pleasure.
I wonder if you may almost, you know, you couldn't, you'd almost have to dedicate an entire different feature to cricket and alcohol as well. I mean,
yeah.
Alcohol in itself, I imagine the role that's played even in recent times is kind of a pretty key one.
Exactly, and it's certainly one of the to look on the rather more morose side of things, cricket and depression and cricket and alcohol are probably quite closely related as well. But there is something actually about food which is quite comforting. And the I was interested to read that when the Indian team were touring the West Indies in 2011, they employed a man by the name of Kapil, we don't know his full name, who was sent out, and wherever they were on whichever island they were, Kapil would find packed lunches with Indian food in them. And one day this wasn't possible, and Virat Kohli just said, you just feel odd when you don't get your own kind of food. Jack Russell, the England keeper, whenever he toured India most famously, but anywhere on the subcontinent, he used to take along with him several suitcases full of baked beans, because he couldn't be without his favourite food when he was abroad.
It's a bit disappointing in terms of the adventurousness of these players. You know, they don't seem like great travellers.
It is, exactly. But there are... there's also money to be made out of food, I think. And Zaya Khan has set up a chain of restaurants in India, although I suspect that's more of a commercial venture than anything else. But my favourite cricketer cook, certainly not my favourite cricketer, but my favourite cricketer cook is Matthew Hayden.
Is that a competitive category for your favourite cricketer cook?
Yes, we'll be shortlisting later. And Matthew Hayden used to take with him on tour a camping stove, frying pan, wok, bamboo steamer and food processor so that he could cook in his hotel room for his fellow batsmen, or the Platinum Club, as he used to call them. Since he's retired, he's written the imaginatively titled Matthew Hayden Cookbook, I have to confess that my research for this didn't go so far as to purchase a copy, but it's actually supposed to be quite sophisticated and imaginative, which is quite different from the... I mean, you'd imagine someone like Matthew Hayden just sort of throwing a kangaroo...
Yeah, I think sophisticated and imaginative were never words used to describe Matthew Hayden.
Like bullish, I think. It's probably the only way it could be.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating in that you get... it comes down again, doesn't it, to this... the cricket getting more professional. And you realise that obviously, you know, what happens to Samit Patel, what's happened to a lot of these people, the demands for greater fitness are going to be there and are only ever going to get stronger. But it is, I guess, worth remembering and being honest about the fact, well, actually... a very talented batsman, I think, in particular, doesn't necessarily need to be svelte. They don't necessarily... And actually, I sometimes think as cricket fans, we're sometimes a bit too sensitive about that. I've been on the end of conversations, cricket's not a real sport, you don't do any exercise. And I think, well, I'm not going to defend my sport because I don't, you know, I don't jump up and down the entire time or I don't run and sprint. I mean, there's so much, you know, let's defend it on other terms.
But there is the... and it does, it's that familiar feeling when... you're playing in a 40-40 game or something for a club side, for a village side, And you go out to field after tea and you just think, please don't make me run. I just want to stand at fine leg for the next 25 minutes and do nothing, particularly when it's a warm day. And it's just that sense that the game does accommodate that. Mm. And everyone slows down. And the batsmen don't take quick singles because they're feeling pretty full after tea as well. And I think there's quite a nice relationship.
Well, and I think it's interesting that the decision, the strategy of, I'll make sure I eat a little bit less, just isn't considered. You know, the idea that you'd actually eat a bit less so that you'd feel fine is just not an option.
So, to the book review, and this episode, we're continuing the multimedia theme that we started with the DVD Out of the Ashes back in the summer. And we are looking at the BBC Radio 4 Sport and the British series, and particularly the episode Cricket and the English Hero.
So this is an ambitious series by the BBC trying to look at the relationship between sport and British history and kind of see how the two connect. And this particular episode focuses on W.G. Grace and Jax Hobbs and says these are two figures who at their different times were heroes, were the dominating heroes, not just of cricket, but actually of the nation. They were huge in a way, particularly in Grace's case, that no sportsman had ever been before. And they try to kind of draw a sort of contrast between them.
I quite like the way that the contrast is drawn between Grace, who was essentially an amateur, who actually took fees and played like a professional and existed very, very much within a sort of commercial setup and was very commercially minded. And then Jack Hobbs, who was the as I sat this morning in my flat in Cambridge preparing for this, I looked out across Parker's Peace, which is a park in Cambridge where Jack Hobbs learned how to play cricket. He was the son of a Jesus. But so Jack Hobbs was very much not, you know, one of the gentleman amateurs, and he was a professional, but he brought into his into his professionalism very much the old amateur values of the game. He was very much a gentleman.
I thought there's a really good quote about Grace during the radio piece where a historian says, a man who is accustomed to be dominant over other men, as a true Grace. And I think that, you know, that does seem to be the constant theme in all writing about
it. With the rather amusing simile of, he says, when the iceberg met the Titanic, there was only ever going to be one winner. When W.G. Grace argued with someone, there was only ever going to be one winner.
And it's funny because that sort of brashness, I think, is something that we generally don't like to define as British. That's very un-British. And the classic example here, and I'm sorry we can't get away from his name, but it's Kevin Peterson. And I could not hear that quote, a man who is accustomed to be dominant over other men, and not think of Kevin Peterson. And I thought, well, it's interesting that in Grace we had a figure, I mean, you know, this is back in the depths of time, obviously, who was hugely nationally popular. And people bought into that arrogance. They bought into that bravado.
Do you buy into the bravado or do you buy into the performance? Because what I've always thought about W.G. Grace is that his performances were amazing and people paid to come and see them. Whereas the difference between that and someone like Jack Hobbs, Hobbs was, you know, probably the greatest English batsman of all time, made, what, 197 first-class centuries. But he just had this image, you know, like someone like sort of Dennis Compton had or someone, of just being a really, really nice chap. Mm. That Grace never had. And I wonder whether it's the same with Peterson, that we're kind of in awe of what he does, but we're not really in awe of him as a person.
I guess that's an interesting distinction. Although I wonder, I think maybe there's some part of all of us that admires, I don't know, that not so much arrogance, but admires that sort of confidence. It's hard to say. I think this series, by the way, they're 15-minute episodes, so what this doesn't do is depth or detail. And in contrast to when we normally review books and where you're pouring through pages and pages, this is really like, it's a snapshot. But I do think the basic idea is quite interesting because Hobbs, as you said, absolute antithesis, self-deprecating, modest. And people bought into him as well. You know, there's not, I'm sorry to use that almost 2020 language of bought into him, but it is interesting that there's not a set mould for a hero. As a nation, we appear to be able to.
I agree. One of the things, I mean, you mentioned this being only 15 minutes long and there's only so much you can do in 15 minutes. I have to say, I found sort of the implications of some of the stuff that was said in this show quite interesting, but I didn't find the show particularly enthralling per se. And actually, I wondered whether, because there's an awful lot of, you know, Claire Balding standing in the long room at Lord's saying, oh, and here are some bats, and here are some, here's the actors.
It's like, interesting. You're
and you think, well, why didn't you actually just take a single theme and explore it rather than, I mean, because it was also a sort of potted introduction to cricket at the same time, wasn't it?
But there did seem something hilariously token about her standing in the Lord's Museum and basically saying, there are a lot of old bats here.
We are in the Lord's Museum, and you can sort of, they've added a bit of reverb in the background.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I thought could have been very interesting to explore was the way that, and obviously this is about cricket and the English hero, but some comparisons I was thinking with other countries, and someone like Shane Watson, who you just think of as the epitome of an Australian. He's blonde, he's muscly, he has a beautiful girlfriend. And
I think this is revealing more about you than it is about Shane Watson. Well, he is the epitome of an Australian.
I think that is. Whereas someone like Sourav Ganguly, who always had trouble kind of getting India on side, it was because I think in a sense he doesn't epitomise what an Indian hero is. He's very bookish.
You've opened a really fascinating question, actually, because that would be a great book to read. I would love someone to write that book. Like, what makes a popular West Indian cricketer is probably not what makes a popular Indian cricketer. You know, what nations kind of relate to in themselves, I think, is very, very different. And I guess to an extent as well, were they cricketers of their time as well? I mean, maybe by the time Hobbs was around, I know their careers very briefly intersected, but maybe by Hobbs' time, maybe that sort of self-deprecation, that modesty worked well at that time, at a time when society was becoming sort of more...
Hobbs made his professional debut in 1905 and played for 30-odd years after that, was at the height of his powers in the interwar years, really. And actually, I mean, there was a national mood then of, I suppose, humility almost, and a sort of reservedness.
I mean, I think it was a very interesting line at one point when someone said celebrity would be the totally wrong word to apply to Hobbs. And I actually think you can make that distinction now with the current England team. Yep. You know, there are those players...
It's like, you know, Alastair Cook is not a celebrity.
Exactly.
But he's one of those people who is uncontroversially liked and obviously a very good... I mean, you were talking about Andrew Strauss earlier on. He's one of those people, isn't he?
Well, he was very... I remember they asked him, you know, why don't you have a Twitter account? And he was like, well, I don't know if anyone would want to read it. And it was self-deprecating, but it was also quite serious. I think he was just saying, well, that's not kind of the life I want.
And I think that's the thing about W.G. Grace. He knew how to milk his position as a cricketer, whereas Hobbs... there's a very interesting, actually, clip from an article at the end of Hobbs' life after he was knighted in 1950 something, and he simply says, if I went back and had my time again and someone said to me, what would you want to do? I just want to play cricket. And it's that sense of just wanting to play cricket. Unlike Grace, who wanted to make lots of money and wants to have lots of fame off the back of it, that sense of just wanting to play cricket is, I think, what defines Hobbs. So, to the debate, and this episode we are asking whether, after an annus horribilis, England are in need of a radical rethink.
It has been a really bad year for England, and I know this comes after what has been a really good year, but they've lost the world number one ranking in a year where many people thought they would kick on and really sort of assert their dominance. And I think it is time for a radical rethink, and I think a lot of people who kind of feel that, you know, England have got it right, that England's there, that kind of Andy Flower and the ECB are kind of beyond reproach, I think it's dangerous. I think I've got a huge lot of support for what we've achieved and a huge lot of support for how it's been run, but I think any good team needs to reevaluate and needs to be confident. I'm going to start, I think, by talking a little bit about the team culture. And I think my issue over the whole, and I hate to slightly drag us back here, but my issue over the whole Kevin Peterson thing is I think it revealed a team culture that was a lot worse than I think what we may have thought, that there were a lot of tensions in the dressing room, and that in itself, I don't think necessarily a problem, the idea that there were tensions in the dressing room. My issue would be the fact that these tensions weren't being dealt with, there were cliques, it was being allowed to fester, and I think, frankly, there was a slight immaturity in a way some of it was dealt. So I think that would be part of my thing. There's perhaps a slightly narrower point, and if this year's have been about anything, a large part of it has been about England and the subcontinent, you know, and it started with playing Pakistan, and the challenge was, can England take that dominance to unfamiliar territory and come out unscathed? And they've just, it's been horrible. And this attitude to the subcontinent is, whether it's fear, whether it's an arrogance, whatever it is, there's something that very fundamentally needs to change, because England's good batsmen are still looking hapless in these conditions. They're still looking struggling. And it's something that really has been an issue for a while. And what concerned me, I think particularly about the Pakistan series, was there genuinely seemed to not have been a serious attempt to prepare those English batsmen for those conditions. They didn't. If there had been, well, I mean, you know, it would have been interesting to see how they would have coped.
I think on both of those, I mean, certainly it has been a poor year for England. Three things. Firstly, looking at it in the context of the last 10 years, if you go from, okay, let's go from 2001 onwards. 2001, England went down to Australia. They lost
4-1.
4-1. That was the day when NASA infamously Australia into bats at Brisbane, and they were 352 on the first day. Coming from then to now, a lot has changed in world cricket. But I think if you put this year into the context of a wider span like that, actually, yes, it's a dip. But that's not to say that it's suddenly 1 year and you're plummeting downhill, and everything else that's happened before has been, you know, has been undone and doesn't count for anything. So that's just kind of a bit of perspective. On those two specific issues, on the issue of the tensions in the dressing room, I don't think actually we're ever really going to know what those tensions were, but it would seem to me that that was very much a one-off thing, and it was very much a Kevin Peterson thing. And it was very much, yes, absolutely, England didn't know how to handle someone like Kevin Peterson, and someone like Kevin Peterson probably actually can't be handled. But I don't know whether it is systematic. And actually, it seems to me that England as a team play together incredibly well, and seem to be a very good unit. Apart from this Peterson issue, I don't think there have been other issues.
Well, I think I'd be encouraged to agree that I think that there appears to be a very good unity when you see England play on the pitch. And that's actually been something that people have come to again and again about this England team. But I think what concerned me about the fallout and sort of the stories that kind of emerged from that was that it did suggest, and I think you're right, that sort of Peterson, we're definitely not going to go down the track of, you know, who's to blame again, but Peterson was the issue. But my feeling was that these tensions were there, and I think a better management system, or perhaps a slightly less complacent manager system, would look to have addressed those earlier, would look to have actually tried to have those conversations earlier. Because I think what's interesting now is it's been messy and not ideal, but I think sensible conversations have been had, and I think things have been resolved. I kind of feel like, couldn't this have happened well in advance of the whole thing blowing up?
Absolutely. Let's not get bogged down in the Kevin Peterson issue, but it seems to me that it's one of those things where it was sort of, I think England probably knew there was a problem. Kevin Peterson obviously is not liked in the England dressing room. Hasn't been for a while, and probably will never be liked by everyone. But as long as he wasn't going to do something like send text to the opposition slagging off his own captain, England were willing to put up with that. So actually, there had to sort of be a kind of breaking point where, however well managed it was. But when I say let's move on, I'm not saying I've won on that point.
You're trying to. So what about, what would you say about this feeling that a lot of England's year this year, and we still will find out much more in the next few weeks, when we certainly want, you know, once the India series kicks off, has been about, you know, can you perform in unfamiliar conditions?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? That's Pakistan series in the United Arab Emirates, where England looked hopeless against spin. And there's a question as to whether it's we have a debate about this, whether it was a technical thing or whether it was a mind thing. And I don't think, came to a conclusion.
A messy conclusion.
But I think that it is a technical thing that needs to be fixed. But I think on that point, I would certainly agree with you that there is something fairly fundamental where that seems to be so unaddressed. And even if it is just a technical issue, the fact that it just has not been addressed until this point. I mean, England have known that they're going to have to go and win in the subcontinent, you know, the final frontier, if they are going to keep their world number one. So in that respect, I would agree. But I think the danger of saying that England need a radical rethink now is that actually you need to put this year into context.
Yeah.
And you need to be able to say, was that series against Pakistan a complete freak? Because sometimes you do get a freak series.
Mm.
And there might be an element of throwing the baby out with the bathwater if you say, okay, we need to change everything because of a bad year, when England, let's remember, whitewashed India in England. India, the current number one side. And so actually, I wonder whether you actually sort of need to see where the trend's going a bit before you do anything
I think the issue I have is that, and I don't want this to come, I wouldn't want this to come across as, you know, one of these totally knee-jerk reactions of, God, we lost a couple of test series, we lost to an excellent South Africa team, like a really, and you know, we competed in that series, I think, despite real disadvantages, you know, despite the Kevin Peterson scandal, despite really having a top order that was woefully out of form, we still managed to compete. And the Pakistan Zoo, I just feel that English cricket has come an extraordinary way. I mean, since we started following the game, and England were almost becoming the joke of the international game, it's come an extraordinary way, but I just feel this needs to be seen. I mean, yeah, beyond, it's extraordinary, really, the development, but it needs to be seen as a constant process. And I feel like the Pakistan series, I think, smacked of arrogance. And my issue with that has been, and my fear continually, after now having seen England go to the 2020 World Cup and play India's spinners as poorly as I think any, you know, you'd have criticised Ireland or, you know, Afghanistan for playing them. It was so immature, it was so poor. I just can't see that action's being taken here. And maybe I'm being simplistic, maybe it's not possible.
It's a difference between sort of rethinking and changing and just learning. Because actually I think there's a lot for England to learn about how you, I suspect in the mind, I mean, I've never been a member of a world-beating sports team. That comes later this weekend.
Still time.
I suspect that there's something very, very new about the mindset of being the best team in the world. And actually it's something that England needs to learn. And England have kind of grown up over the last 10 years, despite themselves, in a sense. I can just imagine there's a sense of, hang on, how are we actually here? We need to get used to being here.
And I wouldn't disagree with the fact that I actually don't think there's, I don't think it's unhealthy for England to find themselves going to India no longer as world number one and to find themselves having to kind of build their way back up. I don't think that's an unhealthy process. And as I said, I would love to see I'd love to see England kind of prove this wrong, because I think the general consensus around this India series is they are really going to struggle in these conditions, and I would love to see England look to prove that wrong.
Thanks for listening to the 36th episode of Reverse Prep Radio. Sorry to have been off the air for a while, but we will be back every fortnight from now on, or every fortnight or thereabouts from now on, to lighten up these long autumn evenings in cricket and chats.